You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahi ahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko me e toku ingoa.
Ko Sophia toku ingoa, nau mai, haere mai ki Various Artists, mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora mea, how are you today?
I'm good, I'm a bit tired to be honest.
Honestly, speak on it. It's been a week, honestly.
It's been a week, but you know what, we're here and yeah, I'm excited.
We've got a lovely show, mea, what have you got today?
Yeah, I caught up with artist Rhys King about his current exhibition on at Anna Miles Gallery, Drop Sheet Snow Angel. So what have you got?
I had a kōrero with Tessa Laird about her latest book, Cinemal, the becoming animal of experimental film, and the book's launch tonight at Audio Foundation.
He aha ofakara, we'd love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patsahi mai, you can text us on 5395 rima toru iwa rima, wai mai rane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also after the show, koa e ware ware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō hei pakihere roki roki maronga e te pai tuku tuku o ere rangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
Cinemal, the becoming animal of experimental film, is artist, writer and senior lecturer at the Victorian College of Arts at the University of Melbourne, Tessa Laird's latest book. Inquisitive, passionate and attentive is Laird as she traces the ways in which experimental films mimic the mystery and magic of animals, examining how they're depicted in film and the animal qualities that transpire in cinema, like scratching and sniffing, vibrant colours and voices. With a focus on films from Aotearoa, Australia and South America, Laird's energetic, observant and illustrative prose brings together personal anecdotes with art history and philosophy. In identifying these cinematic animal tropes, readers are encouraged to rethink what it means to be human in our own animal nature, reminding us that we too are animals. To launch Cinemal, there will be a special screening of films tonight at the Audio Foundation in association with Melanie Roger Gallery. I had a kōrero with Tessa Laird about Cinemal, the becoming animal of experimental film, and the film screening this evening.
My name is Tessa Laird and I am Tamaki Makaurau born, but been living in Melbourne for the last 10 years. And when I was here, I was an artist, writer and art lecturer. It's basically what I still am. I'm doing less art criticism these days, but I'm trying to write longer form pieces, including this book, which I'm here to launch tonight at the Audio Foundation at 5:30. Everyone's welcome. The book is called Cinemal, The Becoming Animal of Experimental Film, and we can discuss what that means. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess some of my background is that I have always been obviously very interested in art, but also simultaneously very interested in the natural world, environmental or ecological politics. And so this book tries to bring some of those themes together, but in a very, I would say, niche way, specifically looking at the fields of experimental film, but through the lens of animal studies.
As you said, you are an artist as well, of course, and in your practice, these ceramic books that you make often are referencing books that you've read or things that are, I'm sure, are quite intertwined with your research practice as well. Talk to me a bit about how you kind of see that relationship between your interests as an academic and as an artist.
So that's really interesting because I went to University of Auckland, and I did a year of Bachelor of Arts doing English literature and things like that. But all my friends went to art school and I got quite jealous of them because it looked like they were having a really great time. So I thought, okay, I'm quitting this. I'm going to art school. But I always had that dual interest in writing and making art. And in the end, I ended up doing more writing than making. And it's always been a kind of a double act for me where I sort of, I'll do a bit of one, then I'll do a bit of the other. And they obviously feed into each other and inspire each other. And I think what's been really interesting, and maybe it's kind of quite obvious really, but as someone who teaches art theory rather than practical art, I'm always reading and I'm always thinking about the connections between theory and practice. And so when I make, I tend to make ceramic copies of the books that I'm reading, which sounds a bit weird. I call this bibliography in the expanded field, and I've been doing it since I did my doctorate at Elam back in 2012. It's a bit of a funny thing to do, but I just like to make copies of books that are really important to me. And I think the funny thing is, maybe not funny at all, or weird thing to think about, is that they may actually outlive the books themselves and possibly any other traces of those books, because, you know, we won't be able to play CDs, or, you know, we won't be able to find computers and files thousands and thousands of years in the future. But someone might dig up a clay book that's still there and think, oh, what's this? So they may be a record of something, if more ephemeral, which I find really interesting and a sort of weird responsibility in a way.
Talking about your latest book, Cinemal, The Becoming Animal of Experimental Film, it's your third book. Can you briefly tell me a bit about the first two, and I guess how did you go about approaching this book off the back of your previous books?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because the first book was called A Rainbow Reader, and it came out of my doctoral studies, which was a sort of investigation of colour. And it was a very kind of a personal book, the way it was written, my personal experiences and memories of colour, but also interspersed with kind of various facts and ideas and discussions of artworks. And then the next book that I wrote in 2018 was A Cultural History of Bats. And that might seem like a bit of a leap, but I'd always been a real fan of bats. And there's a great series called The Animal Series from Reaction Books in London, and they've published literally about 80 or more books, each on a specific species of animal. And being a bat fan, I was always waiting for the bat book to come out, and they'd had everything else, you know, you name it, from ant to snake to flamingo to otter, but there'd never been one on bats. And eventually I got sick of waiting, and I basically just approached the publishers and said, look, would you like me to write a book on bats? And they said, oh, yes, please. We've been waiting for someone to ask us that. And so I did that book, and I was doing all this research on bats, but also this kind of burgeoning field of animal studies, which is an interdisciplinary field of practice or study research. And it involves people from all disciplines, whether that be the sciences or, you know, it could be the social sciences, you know, there's lawyers, activists, art historians, whatever, as long as they are foregrounding animals in their research, they kind of get to participate in what's known as animal studies. So being somebody, you know, primarily interested in the visual arts, I started thinking a lot about animal representation in art. And for the bat book, I was looking at things like, you know, how has the bat been portrayed in literature? Well, you have Dracula. And how has the bat been portrayed in film? Well, you have Batman. But also, you know, Chinese decorative arts, or maybe, you know, Mayan epics and things like that. There's bats in all cultures, and how are they portrayed? So after that, I was kind of deep into the world of animal studies, but at the same time, I was really engaged with experimental film through the work of Tamaki Makaurau-based Ngāpui artist Nova Paul. And I was investigating her colour separation films because I was interested in colour. And she said, well, you've moved to Melbourne, so you should really look up Corin and Arthur Cantrell. They are this experimental film couple from Australia, absolutely legendary. They're really elderly. Check them out. They'll talk to you. And I did. And I became really great friends with them. And unfortunately, Corin passed earlier this year at the age of 96. But I had so many great conversations with her and seen their films. Like, I was just deep in this amazing world of experimental film whilst reading about animals and thinking about animals. And I was trying really hard to sort of think, what's the connection here, you know? And then this idea came to me, this idea Cinemal, which is a hybrid word of cinema and animal. And I first thought the cinematic animal is like, how is the animal portrayed on screen? But then I thought, actually, it's more than that. It's thinking about, is the film itself a kind of lively force? Can the film itself be considered an animal? And the film does have all these really interesting characteristics, especially experimental film. When you think about the way that colour is being used, it's like flashes of colour, like a brilliant bird kind of, you know, displaying itself in a mating ritual. And there's all kinds of, you know, really interesting patterns and colour and light, sort of like you imagine, you know, like an octopus or a cuttlefish, the way that its skin changes. And also the cries of animals, or the repetitions of bird songs, like all of these things are kind of evident in experimental film. And not to mention scratch film, which is kind of literally like an animalistic quality when you scratch directly into the surface of the celluloid. So I sort of had all these thoughts, and I was thinking, yeah, this idea of cinema, it's kind of like giving, ascribing a kind of a liveliness or an animacy to the film itself. And that moment of feeling like, hey, the film is alive, also has a similar effect on the viewer, where the viewer starts to sort of remember that they too are an animal, because we're all animals and we forget that. And we kind of think that we're different from everything else in the natural world. But I like the idea that these films can kind of bring us back to ourselves and our own animality. And also that that might be achieved by changing the way we perceive, because every animal has a different sensory apparatus. And I think some of the interesting things about experimental film is that they can help you see differently by the way that they use, you know, lighting, color, focus or not, and sort of create different intensities of sensation.
Yeah, it's very clear that kind of line of thinking in your practice, holistically looking at where animals and experimental films collide and these depictions and mimicking of each other, and it is continuing these ideas that have been quite present in your practice for a long time. And as you say, these connections between animals and their behaviours and us as humans, although as you say, we're actually all animals and we do forget that. Is there kind of like a personal connection to these concepts that kind of has kept you grounded in exploring these animal relationships over these years?
Well, I guess I do allude to that in the book, and I guess everybody has their kind of their familiar or their animal that kind of has operated as a bit of a gateway or a bridge to the world of animals. And for me, that was a cat that I used to, that used to be part of my life. I mean, she's passed on, but her name was Kira. And in the book, I sort of reflect upon the way that she reminded me of all these other kinds of animals. And she was a tortoiseshell cat. And so like the patterns on her coat kind of reminded me of pattern in general, and the way that patterns get used in film, and the way that pattern appears, you know, throughout our day, whether it's, you know, dappled light created by sunlight through the leaves or something quite simple like that. I think our daily experience is made up of patterns of light and shadow, and these are very kind of cinematic qualities. So I guess I was kind of trying to think about the ways in which cinema is actually an everyday experience. And back to Kira, I just feel like everyone has an animal that kind of speaks to them. So I guess, yeah, she spoke to me, but for everyone it'll be different.
Do you feel like maybe parts of the book will be more relatable for people who kind of know that relationship?
Yeah, I think it helps to have already drunk the Kool-Aid in relation to your pet. If you don't have a strong relationship with a pet, you might kind of roll your eyes at some of the passages in the book. And I think that's sort of what's interesting about animal studies, is you kind of have to be an animal lover to be in animal studies. It's really interesting because all the conferences, all the food is vegan, no questions asked, because there would be some very upset people if we were eating animals in between talking about them.
I was going to ask that. I was like, hold up. I wanted to ask as well, the book intentionally has no photographs or visual imagery within it. Instead, this Friday, of course, we've got the launch at Audio Foundation, which is simultaneously a screening of some of the key films that have been the subject of your inquiry. Talk to me a bit about this choice. Why was it important for you for the films to be viewed in this context and the text to be read without visual reference?
Well, there's a very practical reason. Part of it is because after I did the Bat book, which has 100 images or more than 100 images, I said to myself, never again, because it's actually very hard getting images for publication. You have to clear them for copyright. You have to pay fees. There's a lot of legal back and forth, and it can be incredibly expensive. And I sort of thought, well, these are films, so the best I could do would be to get a still from a film that goes through multiple changes, and, you know, it would only be a very basic indication of what the film contains. It wouldn't necessarily be in colour, and that would be a shame, because it's very important that, you know, colour is a very important aspect of most of the films. And I just thought, what I'm going to focus on instead is description. So I'm just going to try and make the films as evocative as possible, as present as possible for the reader, and hope that they don't actually need to see the film. They can imagine the film. And after all, it's my experience of the film is what I'm writing about. Mm-hmm. So hopefully through my description, they can kind of relive the film.
Mm, that's really beautiful, because in just reading the introduction, is you've got this beautiful language that you use that is very descriptive and poetic, and it does feel like you're in it when you're describing the references that you've made, which is really lovely and impressive. I want to kind of talk a little bit more about these five films that will be featured at the screening, and I guess it will kind of help you to speak a little bit about the scope of the book and some of the things that stood out in your inquiry. You're showing Nova Paul, Sharana, Spong, Arthur and Corin Cantrell, Tina Stefano and Peter Waples-Crowe. You've spoken about a couple of those, but are you able to kind of talk me through briefly each of them and your interest in them, and I guess some of the key things that stood out in each of those films?
Yeah, great. Starting with Nova Paul's work, This Is Not Dying, from 2010. It's a 20-minute film using the colour separation technique that Nova learned from Corin and Arthur Cantrell. And this technique involves filming something on 16mm three times, then getting each of those colour graded at the lab, cyan, magenta and yellow, and then superimposed. And so what happens is anything that didn't move is basically in the full color, but anything that moved during that passage of time ends up being like a colored ghost that kind of wanders through the scene. And this kind of creates this amazing layered effect of beautiful jewel-like colors when you start to think about time as not being linear but layered. And coming from a kind of Te Ao Māori perspective for Nova, this I think says a lot about non-Western, non-linear time and the idea of ancestors kind of being present, and her hapū's land up near Whangarei being kind of a site where daily activities are kind of very complex and layered. They may be very simple things on the surface of things, like kids playing, but there's a whole lot more going on and a whole lot more kind of richness of interactions from all kinds of times in one space, if that makes sense. Film is also a beautiful sort of meditative film because it has a really lovely steel guitar track by Ben Tafferty, who's passed now, but was a wonderful kind of steel and slide guitar exponent. And that provides a really lovely dreamlike quality. So it's kind of, it's gorgeous to both to watch and listen to, but also there's a politics there. There's a real resistance to measured time, capitalist time, colonial time. And that idea of this is not dying kind of recalls that horrible phrase that used to get said about smoothing the pillow of the dying race, which was, you know, the colonial mindset in the early 20th century. And it sort of says, well, you know, this is not dying. We ain't dead. We ain't going nowhere. And this is actually like this incredibly vibrant and beautiful lifestyle that her whānau live on their ancestral lands. Second film will be Myself When 14, which is an Corin and Arthur Cantrell film, but it's with their son, Ivor Cantrell, who's autistic. And he has been throughout his life really encouraged by his parents to pursue artistic practices, and he does an incredible amount. He's absolutely prolific, drawing, painting, ceramic sculpture, and also making animated films with the help of his parents. And in this case, there's a sequence of black and white film that was taken of him when he was 14. And many years later, he went back to this sequence and he rotoscoped it. So that's when you sort of trace over the film with coloured, in his case, coloured felt tip pens. And he does it over and over and over again. And they get the images kind of get more and more wild and expressive and colourful. And there's all these kind of patterns and things that emerge. And he talks over the top of it a bit sort of about the process and the colours, and it has a really fantastic soundtrack by Chris Knowles, which is sort of, it's a bit gamelan inspired, but it's also very kind of 1980s synth pop, and which is kind of funny as well. And it's very repetitive, and it's also very entrancing. And I liken the colours and the patterns that Ivor draws all over his face to the way that I was saying the cephalopods, the octopuses and the cuttlefish, the way that they create colours all over their skins, and it constantly sort of mutates and morphs. And it's just this quite spellbinding visual feast. And the third film that I'm playing is not actually in the book, but it's by my PhD student, Tina Stefanou from Melbourne. She's a Greek-Australian artist who's doing amazing work and just had a fantastic show at ACCA, the Australian Centre of Contemporary Art in Melbourne. And for that show, she was commissioned to make a new film. And it's called You Can't See Speed, and it's a collaboration she made with a blind motorcyclist. So this guy rides dirt bikes with a headset on, and someone is giving him directions. She was fascinated because she's a voice artist, a vocal artist, and for her, sound is everything. And she was thinking about the way that for this blind man, voice was kind of the difference between life and death, or at least, you know, life and a really bad accident. So she collaborated with him, and she films him, and she kind of turns him into this kind of Greek hero in a way. And they have a beautiful soundtrack where, you know, everything that is on screen is being vocalized because it's made so that it can actually be meaningful for blind people as well. So she sings everything that's featuring as an image on screen. And that film also has these sort of strange interruptions of animals. It's got a horse, because the horse and the motorbike she sort of sees as being analogous across different time periods. And then she has these sort of octopus tentacles, and a fish shows up out of nowhere, and it's quite surreal. It's something that I think people here would love to be exposed to. Fourth film is one, I think it's the latest film by Shruana Spong, who's been making films for quite a while now. She makes incredible films, and she did her PhD at Elam and wrote an incredible thesis, which I read, which really helped me gain an in-depth insight into her filmmaking process. Mm. Animals always feature in her films, but in this film, it's called Vague Dog. One of the things that I really enjoy, it's got these kind of little lap dogs, you know, they're really kind of, they're all sort of fluffy, and they've got ribbons around their necks, and they're incredibly cute, but they look like Rococo paintings of women with lap dogs. It was quite a feature of the Rococo era that you'd have these sort of portraits of women, and they'd have this little lap dog with a ribbon around its neck, and it was kind of to do with women's sexuality, I think, and the dog was supposed to represent the suitor or the lover. So this was quite a sort of a feature of these paintings of that period. So Shruana's got these lovely little lap dogs, but she's also got these sequences that are very psychedelic and weird, which are kind of Balinese-style offerings that she's made herself in her own backyard. But they're filmed through some kind of filter. It might be infrared or something like that. And then she's tweaked the chroma so that it's sort of bright orange and lurid purple, And you feel like when you're watching it that you're seeing from an alien perspective, or maybe you're seeing from an animal perspective, because, you know, we all see and experience differently. So that's what I love about these kinds of films, is that in that moment, I feel like I'm something else. Mm. You know, I am, maybe I'm a reptile, maybe I'm an insect, but I just love that moment of being in another world entirely. So the final film is by Peter Waples Crow with the animator Glenn Urquhart. And the film's called, I hope I don't get this too wrong, Budgeri Dialagami Pigaralan, which is in Narigu language. So Peter is from the Snowy Mountains region of Australia, and Narigu are the traditional owners of that land. And Peter is a very proud queer Narigu elder artist who is always making work about his identity. And in this case, with Glenn, they have created together this amazing sort of shape-shifting character who wears a possum skin cloak, which Peter had made himself one that has rainbow-coloured interior. So the possum skin cloak is kind of the traditional clothing of Aboriginal people of the southeast region. He made a wonderful cloak called the Cloak of Queer Visibility, and it had these rainbow colours on the interior. And so in the animation, and this is the only fully digital work out of the five, it's a digital animation, there is this shape-shifting character that shoots rainbows out of the palms of its hand. And it's a very short piece, and it's silent because it was made originally for a projection festival. So it was projected onto the side of a building. It didn't have a soundtrack. And I thought, this really needs some sound. So I asked Phil Dadson if he would perform live just for this very short film. And he said yes. And so Phil is the wonderful, the kind of the legendary musician and artist who founded From Scratch and is well known for his handmade instruments. And there is at Audio Foundation a giant kind of, he said it's sort of like a cello, but it's handmade. And he's going to use that to activate the film.
That was Tessa Laird speaking to me about her latest publication, Cinemal, The Becoming Animal of Experimental Film. The publication launch and film screening of the films just discussed is tonight at the Audio Foundation and is open to all to attend. Doors will open at 5:30 with formal proceedings beginning at 6 p.m. and the film screening running from approximately 6:30 to 7:45 p.m. Cinemal is out now via University of Minnesota Press, and copies will also be available to purchase tonight at the launch event.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
We will be right back after this short break. This is a track from LCD Sound System. This is All I Want. You're on BFM. We'll be right back.
95 BFM presents the Saints 73-78, making their New Zealand debut at the Power Station Friday, October 31. Get ready to have your senses pummeled by punk pioneers Ed Cooper, Ivor Hay, Mick Harvey, Mark Arm, and Peter Oxley. A once-in-a-lifetime gig. It's the Saints, 73-78, live at the Power Station, Friday, October 31. Tickets available now from plusone.co.nz.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95 BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Excuse me, listeners, we've got an announcement to make. Our very own Gang of Four are headed to Verona for a live broadcast, and you're invited. Friday, October 10th, from 7 to 11pm.
So come have a bevy and listen live to the on-point selections of these 95 BFM icons, Renee, Pat, Phil and the Professor.
95 BFM Gang of Four at Verona, Friday, October 10th, from 7 to 11pm.
Thanks to Verona and Decibel Wines.
West Coast, chopping.
Regan, wake up.
West Coast.
Honey,
onshore.
You're having those strange nightmares. Oh, no, no, it's not.
1 out of 10 on both coasts.
Oh, God. Father Damien, it's happening again.
Looking for tubular swells? It's the 95 BFM Surf Report. Is the West Coast gnarly? Is the East Coast bogus? Do people even still use these words? Find out every morning on breakfast and every afternoon on drive. The Totally Radical Surf Report, proudly brought to you by the dudes and dudettes at Probier.
What's it all for?
Various artists.
Rhys King is a Tamaki-based painter currently working from his Otipoti studio after being awarded the 2025 Francis Hodgkins Fellowship. His embodied practice delves into the materiality of painting, diving headfirst into a material-led language in which the painting and its fleeting figures unveil themselves through the act of painting, with King looking to painting as a kind of absorption, an absorption to his surroundings and the way they find themselves into the works. His current exhibition on Anna Miles, Dropsheet Snow Angels, continues in King's embodied practice, presenting a body of paintings, both acrylic on canvas as well as the incorporation of coloured pastels, a beautiful dance between the organic movement and mechanical geometric imagery, a playful and colourful world which showcases King's approach to painting, not as just a practice, but rather a way of being in the world. I caught up with Rhys about the show and overall practice.
Kia ora, I'm Rhys. I grew up in Auckland. I'm a painter. This year I moved down to Dunedin for the Francis Hodgkins Fellowship. I practice, for me, painting is a sort of like a way of life and being in the world, and every day I'd go to the studio and sort of like a garden, I'd tend to it, and the plants sort of absorb the osmosis or photosynthesis, what's around them, and the sun and the roots sort of go deep and absorb what's around them as well, and then eventually they turn into trees and then they sprout flowers.
Wonderful. That's such a lovely way to think about it. Your current show on at Anna Miles Gallery, Dropsheet Snow Angel, showcases a wonderful new body of paintings created during your ongoing time at the Francis Hodgkins Fellowship. I'd like to start this conversation off by speaking a little bit to the title of the show and the kind of ideas behind it. This concept of a dropsheet as this embodied mark-making approach that excludes the mind to some capacity. Do you want to speak a little bit to this?
Yeah, I suppose Dropsheet Snow Angel is like a title among many titles, and it's sort of like a way in that sort of me and Anna came up with among sort of many different ways, and you could approach any show or paintings. I don't really make shows, I paint paintings, and each painting is a show in itself, really. So I think we just came up with the idea of a drop sheet because when I first got to Dunedin, I pretty much had no money and I was painting on drop sheets. And you know, the metaphor is quite cool, like leaving the studio, collecting dirt on your shoes, the world, and then that comes back into the studio and that generates the first mark. I thought that was a nice metaphor.
And this drop sheet is this kind of, painting or work in itself that kind of collects these paint and these marks, but without that mind or without that decision making, it's kind of catches all these little beautiful marks.
Yeah, totally. I suppose like using the tree metaphor like I did before, it's sort of like you don't really know what's around the tree or what's it going to absorb or what's it going to see in its lifetime, but it becomes what it is just through what's around it. And I start each painting just through usually like even just the small marks that are on it by accident through like maybe if it was used as a drop sheet, and then from that the figures emerge, and then I'll give the figure a world and try and let it paint itself really. The marks are like little seeds.
Yeah, wonderful. And emphasizing this drop sheet-like quality, the paintings themselves are presented as unstretched works on canvas, exposing those raw, ripped edges of the canvas and inviting them into the active world of the painting, building on the painting's rich and layered material language. How does working with unstretched canvas shift or kind of add to the works compared to working with a stretched support?
Materially, they're like a lot. I like standing on them and pushing hard with the brush and all that. And if it was stretched, I'm not able to do that. They're quite like sort of connotations of like more traditional making, like Tiapo and stuff. And it becomes more. I've been trying to get away from sort of maybe product or like the art notion of painting and like the product, making a product for the art world. Instead, I'm trying to make something that is. More a nature, I suppose, like a back to the tree metaphor again, like something that grows and feels natural rather than like a perfectly squared packaged painting.
Yeah, because when you start with that already stretched canvas, it kind of, it already has this idea and look of that end product and that those ideas behind the, like the histories of painting in that perfectly square, enclosed kind of frame.
It's always like kind of art fairs and stuff. It sort of puts you off a little bit, painting on nice stretched canvases. Yeah, so I try to go step away from that a little bit.
Yeah. And it's really nice, I notice you paint like right up onto the edges of the canvas, kind of really bringing in those raggedy, tasseled-y bits of canvas, like painting you right up into that. Do you kind of think of those as like, you're working and responding and kind of you're bringing those edges into the works?
Yeah, definitely, like all the little rips and tears around the edges and the eyelets on the top, they all become compositional elements in themselves, and got to respond to them just as much as I would like any brush mark or anything. Yeah, it's all holds like it's all got content and then a bit of balance the weight of the content of each mark like I do with each little thread that dangles off.
Yeah, and within the show you also present a series of smaller works also on unstretched canvas using both paint and the incorporated use of pastels, a colourful and playful grid of 9 works that all seem to occupy this middle rectangular band with each work that nods to a folding of some kind. Would you like to speak a little bit to the series and your method in making them?
I sort of started off, well, maybe a few months into the residency, I started doing them as a sort of a cheap way of using, getting way more colour. So the pastel comes and get in sets of 24, whereas if you buy a tube of paint, it's just as expensive to buy one colour as it is to buy a whole set of pastel. So it's good about bringing colour back in and having a variety that I could choose from. And the folding is sort of a way of, I think like Anna writes about it, like collaborating with myself. Like there's an unexpected, I'll paint half of it and then flip it over, paint the other half and unfold it. And then there'll be an unexpected form there, and I'll respond to that and then finish the painting with it. Try and make it work. But if I start with it, if I look at the painting directly the whole time, and it's sort of like you almost get too caught up in what you're trying to do rather than seeing it for what it is, you start overthinking it and overanalyzing it. But doing half the time, you can the unexpectedness, and you get to step back faster and see it clearer, quicker.
Yeah, that added sense of distance, kind of not getting too kind of internal in it and creating that distance, so you're constantly kind of responding and, like a fresh perspective.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and the install of them in this, like, 9-part, like, 3-row grid, what drew you to install them in this way, like, rather than just a linear line or something? What about that grid kind of worked with that series?
They definitely work either way, and in my studio, I've got quite a lot on the go like that, and I chose those 9 because they sort of went together and then nicely in a weird and a cool way. But mostly it was just the space, like, we didn't have enough room to put them in a line, so we put them in a grid.
Yeah, but I think something wonderful about them being so close together, I don't know if I would have noticed that middle section kind of grid-like thing of the actual paintings themselves if they were maybe separated a bit more. Having them together, forces you to kind of make those connections between them.
Yeah, totally. I think most people don't realise that they're in 3 parts and not until you say something. I think maybe out of, 20 or 30 people that have come to the studio, like, one of them picked up on it.
Oh, wow.
And I really like the in-between, like, nice thing about having them in a grid is the areas, like, the top and the bottom of each painting come together and make a cool painting in themselves, the left and the right of a painting, and the in-between space make a really cool painting. So, like, I want to make paintings based on between the 2 paintings now, like, cool compositions.
Yeah, that's really lovely. And I also wanted to speak to the imagery within your work. It's this beautiful dance between this organic movement of mark making paired with this kind of mechanical geometric imagery with like snippets of figures that fall in and out of the painting. Where does the imagery and forms within your work arise from, or rather kind of call out to or respond to?
I really don't know where it comes from. Like, I don't look at anything in particular. I sort of look at everything, and I like ancient old sort of imagery, and I like, I just walk around and see things and absorb it in, and the figures just appear. Like, it's sort of, I feel like I unveiled them, like they're already there, and I don't really know where they come from. But I sort of like the sense when I see it, it's sort of like, almost like encountering like a wild animal face to face, or like an ant, or like an alien face to face, and at first it's quite, you know it's there and it's in this world, but it shouldn't exist. And then it's quite intense at first, but then sort of when you get to live with it, then it will, enrich your life, I think, if you get used to it and live with it. But it's sort of like creating that weird unknown alien figure at first, but then having it quite familiar enough that you can live with it to change your outlook on life.
So they kind of arise through your making process, and then it's maybe not until afterwards when you take that step back where you kind of, evaluate or encounter them properly for the first time.
Yeah, like I'm always trying to create moments of like pareidolia as much as I can. Each painting, is probably like, there's usually one main figure and countless other figures that constantly keep emerging from around it, and I quite like that. You're painting that you can just keep looking at, and it'll be different every day.
And do the figures and patterns kind of, show up in different paintings, and then you have this series or this body of work that speak to each other, and these different forms keep on popping up?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I don't ever intentionally copy a figure or try and do a figure again, but there are a lot that keep coming back just randomly, and maybe it's just through the way I use line or paint, really, that the sort of lines keep going in a certain way and creating a certain looking figure. But I never intentionally put a figure down or copy a figure or draw a figure, then put it down. The discovery of the figure always happens in the painting.
Yeah, and lastly, what are your hopes for viewers as they enter the space of the show and engage with your work?
I sort of don't want them to come in with anything, but I sort of, if people just sort of think for themselves and be themselves and come up with their own ideas and don't have to be pressured into thinking a certain way, or I think of like everything is right that they think, and be themselves and maybe laugh a little smile, be cool.
Wonderful.
That was Rhys King speaking to me about his current show on at Anna Miles Gallery, Drop Sheet Snow Angel, which is on until the 16th of October.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
We've now got some PJ Harvey for you. This is an acoustic version of Down by the Water. Enjoy.
I lost my heart under the bridge to that little girl. So much to me, and now I moan, and now I holler. She'll never know just what I found. That blue-eyed girl, she said no more, and that blue-eyed girl became blue-eyed whore. Down by the water, I took her hand, my lovely daughter, won't see her again.
This is Sharon Vennett, and then you're listening to 95BFM.
I saw you in, now nothing.
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings in that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tamaki Makaurau. As mentioned on the show, Rhys King's drop sheet Snow Angel is now on at Anna Miles Gallery until the 16th of October.
Also, as mentioned on the show, Tessa Laird's Cinema, The Becoming Animal of Experimental Film is out now via the University of Minnesota Press. The book's launch and film screening is tonight at Audio Foundation from 5:30 p.m.
Breath Spectrum by Nick Austin is on at Coastal Science Gallery until the 25th of October.
Razzle Dazzle by Martin Thompson is on at Charles Nino Gallery until the 18th of October.
Simon Denny's The Future is on now at Michaelette Gallery until the 11th of October.
Ritual Baby, an exhibition by Yuji Iwe's Nikita Emma Hesketh and Warisara Thompson is on at Arts House Trust Par Homestead until the 19th of October.
Tom Collicott's exhibition Constellation is on at Grace Aotearoa until the 18th of October.
Gus Fisher's new group exhibition What We Choose to Remember, as well as Chevron Hassett's Aroha Ki Te Tangata, is on at Gus Fisher until the 13th of December.
Theo McDonald's The Oshima Gang is on at Room Gallery until the 11th of October. Also currently on at Room is Paige Jansen's A Box for All Things I'll Never Learn, also on until the 11th of October.
And Louise Bourgeois in Private View is on at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tamaki until the 17th of May 2026. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Tessa Laird.
And Rhys King.
Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our Instagram at 95bfm various artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Murray. My name is Sophia.
I'm Maya.
And that was Various Artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.